Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Sharon Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my shoe. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, light, love my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my shoe.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
Tune in, Tokyo. That's inappropriate, isn't it? Tune in, Tokyo. I don't know what it is, but it's not right. Something about grabbing people. Well, I'm using it in the prior sense, when we actually had to tune in Tokyo. We had important announcements for the people of the land of Tokyo about an upcoming show that we hope to do there. The strange thing, though, is there seems to be a suggestion that they're not tuned in. Tune in Tokyo. And then how are they going to tune in if they don't know that you're requesting it? It's mysterious. I've just brought myself to a dead halt. You know, most shows start off like this. We have a big show planned for you. It's a great big show with many exciting things. Oh, it's a big show. What a big show. And that's supposed to build some excitement. I don't think it works anymore. I don't think people really listen or hear that. I don't know if they buy it. It seems like a bit of salesman's patter. We glide over that. We wait for the big show to begin. We don't need a big show. We don't need enormous guests. Sometimes if I'm listening to something, they have a big guest in a big show and they do the list of all these exciting things, I become unexcited. I don't want to hear the big guest. Maybe that's just me. I'm just busy tuning in Tokyo. I want them to listen. They're on some other station. I'm trying to break through the megahertz and the waves to get to their particular place and get them to come over to mine, Tokyo. Yeah, I'd read them a note. Dear Tokyo, I wondered if you'd be so kind as to tune in to such and such. Such and such a number on the band, on the radio band, all the little levels of electronic megahertz. Wish I knew more about it, then I'd be more convincing in my story of Tokyo's needing to tune in. So this is the Radio Ghost. We haven't done one of these in, oh, so long, I don't even know. Months. Now, this one is not exactly live. It's live for me, but not live for you. But the plan is, that perhaps soon it will be live. I'm having the Radio Ghost website redone by a very kind gentleman. And part of the new website will be a kind of feature I can stream things live whenever I like, right to the desktop, right over the air, directly to the Radio Ghost website, and you can tune in there. Tokyo. Style. I suppose in some ways I'm telling you to tune in Tokyo to something that may be live in the future, and this is my way of doing it. Now, of course, all the forthcoming live Radio Ghost programs, if that happens, if the website can be reconfigured to accept such things, all of those shows will be big shows, very big shows with big guests. Have I ever had a show with a big guest, a big show? They've always been amazingly small shows with amazingly no guests. I mean, sometimes someone will stop by but usually it's just you and I and a bucket of air. So this radio ghost is really a radio ghost about other radio ghosts, forthcoming live radio ghosts. So we have a very small show for you planned, have a little walk to play later, and maybe some music here and there. And why don't we begin with, Sean came up with something, I haven't listened to it, I probably won't listen to it as it plays. But that's fine, I have to go and get myself some tea. I'll put it in here, and you can listen, and then we'll pick it up on the other side. It's called Big Invisible Boats, and I suppose it's about these boats that are quite large, and you cannot see them. They're not visible, I would suppose. Yeah, and somehow Sean has thought of something to say about these not really yet considered massive ships. Big Invisible Boats by my accomplice, my young apprentice, my strange bedfellow.
If there is a boat in the water, people will go stand near it. They will stand near it as though they are part of its extended organization. They join the loose ropes and anchors and crates. They might think of themselves as onlookers, observers of the boat. But the truth is, all boats are impossible to see. The whole of them is inside, like an inverted organ. So no one looks at boats while thinking that they do. They look especially, instead, at the water and the horizon. Most of all, we are drawn to staring at those places where there is nothing left to see. Deeper than this resides the practical reason of rest. Blinking does not turn the eyes off like the horizon does, or the clearing dissolve of waves, or big, invisible boats. We stand near boats to remember we are empty, and that, like the boat, we cannot be seen.
Whenever I leave the house, it's as though I've stepped into an alien world, and I look around, left to right, up and down, even at my own feet. So I don't quite believe in the place. Or as though something strange has happened that it would be wise to note before I go out. Not exactly monsters hidden in the trees. And perhaps it's just that I need that moment of transition between the cramp of inside and the uncramp of outside. All the walls out here in the world blown away, straight to the stars and further. Today we're on our way to a tree in the woods. I don't know why. Well, I know why. adding to the tree because I keep thinking about it. The image of this tree along the path keeps occurring to me in my brain. Picture of it comes up. I mentioned in the last episode, the one before that, that dead ends were a hobby of mine. Perusing them, experiencing them, finding their point of death, where they died, into the forest or into a mound. But something else that I like to do, and I wouldn't call it a hobby, is I tend to follow up on tiny recollections and images of things. Things that stay with me for no reason that I can say. So if I picture a bench downtown, even if I've seen a bit of trash somewhere, somehow I'll be curious, is that trash still there, that wet wrapper, that can by the side of the bank? And I'll try to remember as much as I can about the can. Is it blue and silver, red and green? And it won't have been a can that I stared at over long, as though I'm a can starer, but something I saw peripherally that then popped up later into my mind. And as though a photograph, I'll try to bring it more into clarity. Stare at it. So staring at a peripheral memory that was only there for a moment in which I did not concentrate on, which held no interest for me at the moment, and yet remains as a part of the cinema strip. I always think that after I've looked over these, well, they're not even really discarded images. They're byproducts of experience. But I feel that after I've re-perused them, or even I'm seeing them for the first time in many ways, I feel as though the image that I have of the can, which I'll decorate with words and pictures, colours and a certain style of crushing, to me seems much more legitimate than the actual can I'll find by the bank. And usually there is no can there anymore, no bit of wrapper in the gutter. But when, and I don't know if that means they were never there in the first place, and I've superimposed the can that was in front of the coffee shop or some other place, and I've stuck it in there. It may be that all of our images get jumbled together, reconfigured, refashioned into some, I don't know, some streamlined version of events. Maybe something about walking past the bank actually did hold my attention. Perhaps I saw an interesting person. But then while walking by the cafe, all there was a can, but nothing else. And maybe the mind takes the can and puts it near the bank where an actual slight experience took place, where my awareness did come into its presence, where I was looking actively at something, not the can, but there is no reason after that to remember walking past the cafe, and so I discard that, keep the can, throw it in the bank. Not in the bank. But so I think that these... these clarified peripheral images that I come up with are more legitimate than the real. As I said, usually the can is gone or the wrapper's not there. But on the times when I have discovered, we'll keep with the idea of the can, when I have come back and found the can, it's nothing like what I've put together in my mind. And yet, I find that the real thing less convincing. I've put so much work into my imaginary version of the can that I don't even want the real one anymore. Imaginary can has a story. Old man driving by in a pickup truck drinking beer. His wife doesn't want him to do that anymore. He throws it out the window at the bank. He doesn't like the bank manager. Little boy eating a lollipop inside the bank, waiting for his mother, goes outside, steps on it. I come by, and there it is. It's hard to lose those bits of story that we attach to things. And we do it all the time. It's why it can be so difficult to convince us of the truth of something after we've labelled it all up with our own sense of story. We don't see ourselves doing this. It's just what happens. It's why we dream at night. We're constantly inventing and assuming and creating reasons for things in the form of story. And it is why we like stories in some way. Because they are very well expressed reasons of things. And by reason, I don't mean simple explanations. The can is there because a man threw it. The can is crushed because a boy stepped on it. The reason is more that why it is there and how it has come to the state it's in. To sense those things, the function of the human being as it relates to an object, as deep as possible. And you can keep going with the story of the man in the truck or the boy with the lollipop. And the deeper you go with it, the more real that can is, the more correct and interesting is its position by the bank. The more beautiful the way it appears, the crushed quality of it can become almost iconic. Until in the far background and foreground of the story of the can is a great tragic love story. It all resides in the can, or it emanates from the can, or you can find it in the can, and we look for those things. We assemble. Now, so this tree that I wouldn't say it. One, two, three. This tree that I would like to say is haunting me, but it's not frightening in any way, but it keeps being there. There it is again. There it is stirring my coffee. There it is. I'm not drawing to it. There's nothing fascinating about it. It's just another tree. I'm intrigued about, because I wonder if there's not something else around it of some importance, or perhaps it's the tree itself I'm meant to visit. Or perhaps it's that I needed to discuss an idea that I had only kept wordlessly inside about the can. And how these disparate, peripheral sensory experiences can be conglomerated into one somewhat streamlined history. It all collapsed together. But maybe there's, I don't know, I can't even speculate. I mean, at the moment, of course, I'm picturing a can next to the tree that the old fellow threw there, the drunkard, and then the boy with the lollipop stepped on. That's fair enough, I guess. It's meant to snow. And it's evening, so there's still some light. But there is in the air that feeling, that bit of a shiver. There's a bit of misery in the atmosphere before a snowstorm. Silver grey. It would be misty, but it's taken all the moisture up. And it could be even that it snows before it snows, that the snowflakes are falling even now, but they're so small and fine, I can't even see them. Or, then, there could be one official initial snowflake that falls from the sky. The number one snowflake, a strange and odd fellow with a queer face. Very unlike all the more normalized snowflakes that will later fall. It would be large and lumping. Perhaps it's wrapped itself around a bit of grit. Tiny flake of volcanic ash. There are thousands of tons of debris floating in the air. Maybe even more than that. Maybe millions of tons. Or maybe only a ton. I don't know. Here comes the dog and his owner. Oh, there. Hello there, little doggy. Cross-country skier. Skiing all the way across this fine country, as they almost do. They're cross-country, cross-the-country skis. I don't think it's called cross-country skiing anymore. It's too homespun. They've turned it into something sportier. Nordic skiing. Adventure pants. Slidey wood. Now, I'll tell you why that's somewhat odd and mildly irritating. The presence of the skier. Almost offensive, but it's not. But very simply, I broke my own trail through the woods just now. It's a kind of a straight shot that I know of, but it's not an official path. But it's a fairly easy way through the woods. And I just slav them along. Now, what is mildly bothersome is that this cross-country skiing fellow followed my track. And I suppose that means that he was behind me somewhat, saw me, and then is either following my footsteps in the snow. I don't know. I mean, I myself do that. If I go off and I don't know where I am, I see footsteps or ski trail, I'll walk along that. Maybe he saw my boot prints and that was it. He followed them, thinking they were old, and instead he found an old man. And honestly, it doesn't sit well. It doesn't feel right when a sporty person finds a non-sporty person in the middle of nowhere. He looked at me oddly. And what are you doing out here in boots and boots alone? Where are your adventure pants? Where are your slidey woods? Why aren't you travelling across the country? So I stood there, like I'd been guilty, like he'd found me out. Like I'm a kind of nudist, trying to sunbathe alone by myself in the woods. I once made my way along to a river, and it's a very gorge-like river. Deep down, you have to go along a pretty sharp cliff. There's a great pool at the bottom, and rocks, enormous glacial erratics, I suppose they call them. I like saying that, even if they're not glacial erratics. It's quite a fine day if you get to say so. I get down to the bottom, and up from this pool of water pops a completely naked woman, and she clambers up onto the stone, and I turn away, and I'm saying, I'm sorry. She looked at me with such venom. She wrapped a towel around herself, grabbed her things, ran off. I wanted to explain to her, I had no idea. I'm sorry. As though I was out looking for skinny dippers, and there she was. I found her. I went running down to behold her. What a crazy thought that would be. Some old man running down a cliff in the middle of the forest, searching out the naked people. I still am explaining this to her in my mind, years later. I keep trying to convince her. We have these never-winnable arguments. I feel as though I've never convinced anyone of anything. I myself feel utterly pliant. I don't know if that's true, but it feels to me that way, that you could convince me of anything, and that I'm waiting to hear what the reasons for such and such are. But if I knock someone's coffee over at a restaurant, I feel as though they've already stamped me with guilt. They've known all along that I was going to do it, and they've seen video footage of it, and they knew that I did it on purpose. I'm sorry. This makes me seem rather abject. And I'm not. I'm not an abject character. I just seem to not be able to convince anyone of anything, of my clumsiness or the accidental nature of my wanderings. I'm not, in fact, here on Earth to knock people's coffee over, interrupt their cross-country ski treks, or discover them while they're bathing in the nude. Honestly, I walk 1 mile per hour. That is a rough pace. I don't know if there's another animal that walks that slow. I'm almost on the insect level. Ladybug speed. Perhaps a spider. I mean, I know sloths are slow. I don't know if they go walking across the forest. They just seem to be slow going up their trees. I wonder if they're extremely slow deer. They just take their time. They never run. They hate to run. They just don't want to. They're through with it. I'm going to walk my way at this leisurely pace, very undeer-like, to where I go, and where I go is what I get. That's what it is with animals. Where they go is what they get. So I suppose that's why they're not slow. They always have to be getting somewhere where there's something to be gotten. A few seeds, a bit of rubble, animal food. I've often worried about animals being cold at night. I'm sure the deer are cold when it's 20 degrees below zero. But are they? I don't know. No one will tell me. There are so many of these facts, situations. I don't know if they've been studied. I'm sure they have. But what if deer were cold all the time? I mean, I don't mean in summer. But the whole winter long. Just one long, horrible shiver. Moment after moment of, oh my God, it's cold. And I'm a deer. I know they have fur, but it's not much. It's a thin little coat. Bare feet. I don't know if those feet even feel those little deer paws. They put them down on the cold ice. They feel it. Probably not. Then they have to lay down in the snow. That can't feel good. They lay together as though they have a vague idea of warmth that it might be had through some kind of collective deal. But I don't think they lay on top of each other like mice do. Mice have figured that part out. Get a cold room and half dozen mice. There's a mouse pile for you. All together. Like a glove that won't. It's hard to believe these birds are singing to you. Chickadees and sparrows. And for the massive amounts of birds there are, you don't see enough nests. I rarely see a nest, although I am fairly blind, so I could be surrounded by nests. But I don't, in my past, when I was better equipped and the eyes worked, I saw but one or two bird nests. They're not around. And squirrels, too. I don't know where they live. I know it's nests, but I never see them. Great big basketballs of twigs in the top of the trees. Of course, I've seen one or two, but thousands of squirrels around. The trees should be just blossoming with stick-like basketballs. I think raccoons live in trees. I don't know what they're doing up there. So large. Must always be falling out. I completely forgot to look for the tree. That cross-country skier absolutely threw me off, because at once I went into my recollection of the skinny dipper, because I was presented, that's how it feels, with some dose of guilt. I don't really feel the guilt. I feel as though someone is looking at me as though to say, don't you feel guilty? And I suppose I feel some little astringence. But it's more that I have to work through that. Why would I be guilty about being out here in my boots and he's in the skis? Why would I be guilty if I came accidentally upon this remote swimming hole and you were here? How can you reason together? I'm fighting with her again. I'll stop. Well, so that's blown. The whole mission. Mission status failure. Mark it down in the books with your black pencil. Mark it down in your books with your black pencil. Which apparently is something that I say when missions have failed. Now, this is a short episode of the Radio Ghost, and we're going to say that that is all. That was the big show. If you detected bigness in it, perhaps you were listening a little too closely to the Invisible Boats piece, which I must say I did not understand at all. But that's fine. I don't need to understand it. I didn't disagree with it or find it unworthy. I just would not know how to explain it to anyone, except to say it's about big invisible boats and you and I and how we are like them. So, my friends, we shall say it is time and I am late, and we will see you soon on RadioGhost.com. It's time and I'm late. The old frozen fire, turn out the light. Tomorrow we'll slip through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sleeping in sleepless light, come dreams to a sleeping light. But now it's time to swim.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire, turn out the light. Tomorrow
tomorrow. Sleep through town, side ever turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep.